In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, Dr. John Marciano continues his public seminar series with Empire as a Way of Life, a monthly lecture and discussion presented until June of 2007. Dr. Marciano says about Empire as a Way of Life, "A fundamental purpose of our meetings is to understand the systemic nature of the U.S. Empire and the economic and military imperialism that is its lifeblood." The historian William Appleman Williams argues that empire became a way of life in the U.S., a combination of patterns of thought and action that, as it becomes habitual and institutionalized, defines the thrust and character of a culture and society. This way of life has convinced many U.S. Americans they have a right or manifest destiny to impose their political and economic policies upon others. The lectures are given at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Dr. John Marciano is Professor Emeritus, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com.
So, William Appleman Williams' Empire as a Way of Life originally came out in 1980. This is the new edition with an introduction by Andrew Bacevich. My comments will begin with a critical review of Andrew Bacevich's introduction and some of William's major arguments from chapters 1 through 5. I will also share some critical reflections on empire from historians Charles Beard, J.A. Hobson, and D.G. Kiernan, and the English filmmaker and writer Felix Green. The examination of Williams will emphasize the fundamental premises that shaped the founding of the nation, particularly the views of James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. These two founders helped set in motion a basic structure of empire that has remained intact for two centuries. Bacevich, who wrote the introduction to this new edition, is a Vietnam veteran who has taught at West Point. He currently is professor of international relations at Boston University and author of two fine books on U.S. foreign policy, American Empire and the New American Militarism. Bacevich argues that William's influence has endured for one simple reason. U.S. foreign policy has vindicated his views on the nature of government and empire, even though Williams was denounced at that time by Cold War apologists for venturing outside acceptable bounds in his criticisms of U.S. policy. As long as you stay within these bounds, you can make tough methodological criticisms, that is, things are not working. But you cannot question the fundamental premises of the policy itself. For example, present the kind of critique that Noam Chomsky does. This will not do and will ensure you will be ignored or attacked in the New York Times. Williams' crime was to suggest in the midst of the Cold War that the U.S. entertained imperial aspirations, and that U.S. foreign policy had aimed at building and consolidating an American empire. This major assertion, Bacevich points out, has stood the test of time. The fundamental question that Williams raised is whether this nation is even possible without empire. Since it has always relied on expansion, especially economic expansion, can it learn to live within its own means? The short answer is no. As the radical political economy analysis of John Bellamy Foster and others in this course show, the inherent nature of modern capitalism propels it inexorably toward expansion. It cannot live within its means, and any attempt to produce political reforms designed to accomplish this are doomed to failure. In Bacevich's view, Williams subscribed to his own version of American exceptionalism. What I believe is one weakness within Williams' fine and powerful critique of U.S. policies. All views of American exceptionalism are built on a fundamentally flawed premise. That is, that the history of this country is different than others in terms of economic and political issues. And we must tie this lack of exceptionalism to the fact that capitalism is incapable of self-restraint. Like a shark, it must keep moving or die. It can't be self-sustaining and frugal, for that undermines the very nature of a political economy built upon relentless expansion. One of William's basic arguments is that unlike the time when he wrote this book, originally, 1980, the notion of empire was common in the vocabulary of the Americans who made the revolution against Great Britain and then produced the U.S. Constitution. These men knew the ideas, language, and reality of empire from their study of the classic literature about Greece and Rome and about politics in general. They used the word regularly in their talk about England, and they came increasingly to employ it in speaking of their own condition, policies, and aspirations. It became, indeed, synonymous with the realization of their dream. The brutal honesty of the early founders, however, diminished as the country grew, and the ideological justifications for imperialism glossed over reality with such phrases as extending the area of freedom and saving the world for democracy. Even as the U.S. destroyed the cultures of first Americans, conquered half of Mexico, and relentlessly expanded its power around the world, empire became so intrinsically our American way of life that we rationalized and suppressed the nature of our means in the euphoria of our enjoyment of the ends. William's major arguments represent, first and foremost, a social and historical analysis that stresses patterns that become habitual and institutionalized and define the essential character of a culture and society, not psychological or individual explanations that seek to explain large historical events by focusing on micro and idiosyncratic tendencies of major leaders. Therefore, we have to look at the basic assumptions that each society holds in common about reality. That's what Williams is arguing. As those assumptions guide and set limits upon its members, their awareness and perception, their understanding of causes and consequences, options and range of action. These assumptions are based on hierarchical and unequal class relationships. The imperialism of the founding was similar to what English historian J.A. Hobson argued a century ago about the new imperialism of his era. It is particularly relevant to our contemporary understanding of U.S. foreign policy. He stated, "Although empire has been bad business for the nation, it has been good business for certain classes and certain trades within the nation." So when we hear that we fight to defend and preserve our national interest, simply ask, whose national interest? And what is the direct economic outcome of that interest and imperialism? Williams argues that it is absolutely critical to understand the nature and importance of empire in the founding, because from the beginning, this way of life effectively closed off other ways of dealing with the reality that Americans encountered. Once this fundamental premise or foundation was laid, subsequent U.S. history has been very predictable, right down to our imperial ventures in Afghanistan and Iraq. From the founding, this fundamental structure was dominated from the start by those Williams called important people, because they are, in or out of government, the human beings who order the priorities and relationships in terms of a system. They integrate the parts into a whole. Despite 220 years of different administrations, Democratic or Republican, the policy has been systemic and constant, not haphazard or ill-conceived. The founders who formed the nation and created the empire gave serious and intelligent attention to governing a people, and their views are absolutely critical and relevant to the present. Why Williams tells us that 20th century Americans liked empire for the same reasons their ancestors favored it, because it provided them with renewable opportunities, wealth, and other benefits and satisfactions, including a psychic sense of well-being and power, we must keep in mind that the material benefits of empire do not benefit all equally. Most wealth goes to the ruling elites, even though all citizens may share in the ideological benefits that accrue from nationalist and patriotic appeals. Williams forthrightly tells us that from the founding, as a nation, we have from the beginning had alternatives to empire, as various minorities and occasionally pluralities have from time to time argued and agitated for a non-imperialist outlook. We must agree with Williams, however, that the U.S. was born and bred of the British Empire, such so that the founders sought to coordinate, even to plan their efforts to realize their desired goals. They were in truth concerned to create a system through a conscious effort to integrate disparate elements into a purposeful pattern. This was not some dark and mysterious conspiracy, but a development based on planning and a relentless attention to class interests. As we discussed in our first class, Williams agrees with John Locke's definition of empire, a way of life that involves taking wealth and freedom away from others to provide for your own welfare, pleasure, and power. Ah, what honesty. We can only have that today. We have returned to this quote because it brilliantly captures the essence of the empire project that we seek to examine. Thus, the basic issue remains, it was and remains, the control of wealth and the liberty of some to do as they choose. It's essentially about constructing a social order based on the fundamental fact of having more than one needs. This is why we must focus on the beginning of the U.S. and the confident and articulate founders who created the ground rules upon which have been built subsequent centuries of imperial aggression throughout the world. Williams believes we have to understand the bricks from which they built the important foundation. John Winthrop's faith in America as a city on the hill and then as another Israel was echoed in the remark of Puritan leader Jonathan Edwards that God might in America begin a new world in a spiritual respect. Williams reminds us that founder and later President John Adams believed the colonial era was only the opening of a grand scheme and design in Providence for the illumination of the ignorant and the emancipation of the slavish part of mankind all over the earth. The founders could certainly turn a phrase, there's no doubt about that. This sentiment was rephrased slightly by his son, John Quincy Adams, who described the U.S. as a nation coextensive with the North American continent, destined by God and nature to be the most populous and powerful people ever combined under one social compact. Such views have been the dominant perspective since the founding. Rephrased generation after generation, with rare dissent by conservatives and liberals, Republicans and Democrats. Whatever tough criticism you may hear today with regard to the handling of the empire by the Bush regime, you will not find one influential political figure that will challenge the fundamental premises of empire. This dominant view was restated after the 9/11 attacks, for example, by historian Victor Davis Hanson, quoted him in the first course. He assured us that our country was not merely different than others, but was clearly superior with its rare democratic government, tolerance for religious differences, spirit of liberty, and allowance for dissent. William Bennett, moral philosopher and former Secretary of Education and gambling addict who blew $8 million in Vegas, has restated John Adams' grand view of America, asserting the basic truth that we live in a self-governing society that stands for freedom and self-government. Bennett believes that nowhere else has freedom flourished as it has in America.
Even with its faults, America remains the best nation on earth. A fair reading of our history will reveal once again that we truly are the last best hope of earth. He took that line from Jefferson, which we'll get to in a moment. Of the influential founders, James Madison was arguably the most important in terms of nation and empire. And we need to listen to Williams and devote some careful attention to him, that is to Madison. Both in the mind of Madison and in its nature, the Constitution reflected the premise of imperial government at home and abroad. What Madison, of course, was not alone in his advocacy of nationhood based on class principles and imperialism based on expansion, first against American Indians and then onward to the Caribbean, Canada, Latin America, and the rest of the world. While all the founders, according to Williams, were impressively literate and knowledgeable about history and political theory, and they were, it was Madison who presented the strongest case that empire was essential for freedom. This international view complemented Madison's view of domestic government, found in his arguments on the nature of society and rulers in Federalist Paper number 10, in the view of many, the most important political essay ever written in this nation. In this essay, Madison was honest and blunt about the nature of government and social classes. And I quote, "The most common and durable source of factions has been the various and unequal distributions of property. Those who hold and those who are without property have ever formed distinct interests in society. The regulation of these various and interfering interests forms the principal task of modern legislation, and involves the spirit of party and faction in the necessary and ordinary operations of the government." Historian Charles Beard called this a masterly statement of the theory of economic determinism in politics. The truth, but a view that cost Beard dearly. It is this class nature of political economy and government that was the essential foundation for empire. It is here where we must begin to understand U.S. expansionism since 1789. Alongside Madison was the other major architect of empire, Thomas Jefferson. For Williams, Jeffersonian democracy was a creature of imperial expansion. He, perhaps more than Madison, established it as a way of life. And most Americans embraced it because it gave them personal and social rewards. Building an empire generated even larger visions and allowed the U.S. to give the law of our hemisphere. In truth, however, Jefferson, Madison, and other founders made and unmade that law by signing and then breaking innumerable treaties and other agreements with first Americans and by extending slavery as an integral part of their empire. Williams reminds us that citizens here came very quickly to view themselves as having discovered the ultimate solution to mankind's long search for the proper way to organize society. He means white citizens of Western and Northern European backgrounds. Jefferson took this view when he stated that America was the world's best hope. One is staggered, however, by the depth of denial about what America of that time truly represented in this comment by one of the most brilliant founders. Jefferson asserted a reality that totally erased the class, gender, and racial inequalities that marked the U.S. at that time. Charles Beard challenged the class nature of the founders' views decades ago in his controversial and groundbreaking book on the origins of the nation entitled An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution of the United States. Beard demolished the notion that the founding was a simple tale of the working out of a higher will than that of man. There is to be observed in the history of the struggle for the Constitution, in historian George Bancroft's words, the movement of the divine power which gives unity to the universe and order and connection to events. So it was divinely inspired. Now, how can one oppose the founding Constitution that forms the basis of empire itself, therefore, when all of this has been divinely ordained? Of course, this is the same ideological mystification that present U.S. rulers use as their justification for imperial assaults around the world. Of course, the critical view that Beard and other historians have presented, that is, the hypothesis that economic elements are the chief factors in the development of political institutions, has rarely been used to examine the governmental and imperial development of the United States. Aside from the critiques of such scholars as Noam Chomsky, Michael Parenti, and Howard Zinn, and John Bellamy Foster, whom we read, Beard's thesis has been ignored and or attacked for its economic determinism. He was castigated for daring to suggest that class interests were the fundamental concerns of the founders in Philadelphia who debated and created the Constitution. Despite Beard's critique, the mainstream view articulated by Bancroft in the 19th century and repeated each generation since has remained the dominant perspective that has shaped our education on the empire. Williams recognizes that capitalism, with its fundamental principles of private property and class system, is challenged by the ideas and ideals of community. Therefore, these ideas and ideals are only possible through empire that provides a surplus of property. That's if you accept certain assumptions. But of course, this means an appropriation of the surplus by some. And the progression of U.S. history proves that more and more wealth-producing property has ended up in fewer and fewer hands. Critical to the nature of empire, in Williams' view, was the ideological support represented by Adam Smith's view on political economy. Often referred to as the founding guru of modern capitalism, Smith repeatedly underscored the importance of the state in expanding the marketplace. His entire system was predicated on unending growth upon empire. He wholly agreed with the necessity of expansion. Williams asks us to remember the words Smith used to define the purpose of his political economy system: the prosperity, the splendor, and the duration of the empire. By the early decades of the 19th century, it goes without saying that President Andrew Jackson accepted empire, as his aggression against first Americans led inexorably to what Williams calls the ultimate magic phrase, manifest destiny, created by editor John L. O'Sullivan. For O'Sullivan, America was the beginning of a new history, which separates us from the past and connects us with the future only. Who will, what can, set limits to our onward march? Our mission is to smite unto death the tyranny of kings, hierarchs, and oligarchs, and carry the glad tidings of peace and goodwill. Brings tears to your eyes. This is America, the grand exception to the age-old tradition of greed and power among states. If only it were true. One of the most difficult things to accept is that we are like many other empires, Rome, Spain, and England. As they, we have not risen above the brutal and criminal realities of aggression. Williams' analysis of U.S. history perhaps reaches its grandest moment with his insistence that we end the denial about our true history and confront finally the reality that the history of the United States is not the history of anti-imperialist heretics. It is the account of the power of empire as a way of life, as a way of avoiding the fundamental challenge of creating a humane and equitable community or culture. This quote cannot be emphasized too strongly, for it points to the essential nature of the government and ourselves as a people, coming to grips with what is truly at stake then and now. Despite the reality of our imperial history, leaders and intellectuals can tell us with a straight face that we still need to go forth in the world spreading democracy, as if a nation built upon genocide, expansion, and slavery, upon empire as a fundamental way of life, can possibly spread anything but misery wherever it goes. The basic message we were taught in schools and elsewhere, that we go forth to do good for others, must be confronted and ripped out by the roots if we are ever to hope to build a genuine democracy and foreign policy that respects the decent opinions of humankind. Beginning with the eloquent and articulate rhetoric of our founders, we heard the grand defenses of empire from the ruling class. In the words of Hobson, the noble phrases expressive of their desire to extend the area of civilization, to establish good government, promote Christianity, extirpate slavery, and elevate the lower races. Sound familiar? The English filmmaker and writer Felix Green presents a powerful anti-imperialist critique in his book from the 1970s, The Enemy, What Every American Needs to Know About Imperialism. He points out that the United States was the first nation to be founded openly on the right of revolution, on the proposition that a people may legitimately abolish their existing government, if necessary by force, and institute a new one. The principles propounded by the American colonists were at the time explosive. Other principles were adopted that struck the ruling classes of Europe as terrifyingly subversive. But this grand vision and threat carried with it, according to Green, a fatal flaw. A society built on the principle of human equality could not at the same time be a slave society, nor could it condone the ruthless massacre of indigenous Indian peoples. Nor is human equality possible while the means of production remain in private hands. It is the private control of the means of production, the means, literally the means of life, that we must ultimately confront, for it forms the foundation upon which empire is built. It leads inexorably to the economic exploitation of other peoples, buttressed by military and political domination. Green reminds us that the basic aim of imperialism is to make the maximum profits, to exploit, to dominate. Imperialism of necessity also involves the defense of the social order out of which it developed, the home front. This is a key point often missed by critics of the means and results of imperialism that do not examine its essence or inherent qualities. He continues, of necessity, it must accept a series of assumptions about people and their relationship to each other. Within the very core of capitalism, there lies the assumption that it is normal, natural, and right for individuals of one class to reap wealth at the expense of those who actually produced it. Well, if it is acceptable for one group to exploit others within their own country, then logically it is clearly normal, natural, and right for this class to search for ways in which it can enrich itself by exploiting people abroad as well. The issue starts at home. These brilliant and penetrating insights are absolutely essential if we are to understand the links between the inherent nature of the internal capitalist system and empire and exploitation abroad. An empire can only be administered by a people who feel supremely certain that they are right, benevolent, and just, Green asserts. Our intentions are good. That's what matters. We mean well, for at heart we are a generous people. We must keep this insight in mind when we hear that our leaders have generous and fine intentions toward the people of Iraq or Afghanistan. So much so that the U.S. must stay there to help them on the road to democracy and safety. Green critiques the benevolent argument the founders made about America, that from the beginning we were made to feel that the very survival of civilization in some way depended on what we did. This self-righteous sense and identification of America's interests with the interests of the world is explained and justified with all kinds of mystic talk about the nation's destiny, that it was in some way ordained. We deserve this role because of our quite exceptional qualities. And through a process well known to psychology, Americans' own unrecognized hostilities and aggression are projected on others. The notion that we could possibly be aggressive, cruel, and exploitive was thought to be ludicrous. That is, until Vietnam. In his book, America, the New Imperialism, From White Settlement to world hegemony, the Scottish historian V.G. Kiernan compliments Green's critique of empire and American exceptionalism and benevolence. He states that the United States was never an Eden of primal innocence. It had been rearing a crop of rich merchants and shipowners whose eyes were often turned toward overseas endeavors. These were men born with an imperial spoon in their mouth. The calls for empire continued in the mid-19th century. Heavenly trumpets were sounding in the West as well as the South. And during the Mexican War, one congressman, speaking for many, called on Americans to press on to the Pacific and fulfill the destiny of the Anglo-Saxon race, mindful of that high position which Providence had assigned them. By marching forward, America would prove herself worthy of the divine favor. Of all the providential designs, the most heinous was directed against first Americans, and perhaps the worst of that was against the Cherokee, resulting in the infamous Trail of Tears that we have discussed. Their language was a written one, and in 1827, they adopted a constitution on the U.S. model and claimed sovereign status. But in 1838, they were deported to Oklahoma, the abode assigned to the five civilized tribes. Kiernan tells us that before Andrew Jackson retired from the presidency, he wrote the Cherokee a letter, exhorting them to see it was all for the best. In what must go down as one of the clearest and coldest expressions of the empire imperialist mentality, Jackson stated, "Circumstances that cannot be controlled and which are beyond the reach of human laws render it impossible that you can flourish in the midst of a civilized community." Alongside the patently ignorant and racist Southern whites, the Cherokee were a model of a cultured, refined, and civilized people. A fundamental part of empire and manifest destiny at mid-century, of course, was the institution of slavery, which was illegal in Mexico. Kiernan tells us that during the 1830s, as the abolitionist campaign was getting underway, the South became all the more anxious to enlarge its sphere of influence. Slavery soon complicated the debates about how much Mexican territory was to be annexed. Between spreading civilization and spreading slavery, there was an all too visible discrepancy, a fundamental contradiction, and it was generally feared by the anti-slavery party that any more lands taken from Mexico would, like Texas, be fresh breeding grounds of that evil. In summary, we must come to realize that the structure of and desire for empire transcends borders, governments, and so-called democratic ideals, and that its foundational premises and principles were set in motion by the very forces and figures that brought the United States into being as the last best hope of Earth. Thank you. Why don't we resume?
I'm Jay from Santa Monica. After reading Williams, it seems to me that his overwhelming primary focus is on the experience of the United States. And I've asked myself many times as to the comparisons of one particular experience to previous historical experiences. And that's really the question that his article raises in my mind tonight, and that is, why is the U.S. experience any different than any other empire experience? We could go down the list from Hitler, Napoleon, et cetera, in their desire to simply conquer space, number one, and secondly, conquer market. Why is this United States experience any different than all those others?
Anyone want to respond to that? I'll have a comment on it, but...
Just logically, because we had all this open land, well, supposedly, theoretically open land, whereas those entities didn't. So the expansion was inherent in the dynamic.
Well,
Liebenstrom, I think it was called, the Hitler thing for more space, the Soviet Union expansion after the Russian Revolution was more space, Napoleon was more space.
But they couldn't make believe that they were expanding into empty space.
Well, many of them felt that they were. I mean, the Chinese, the Han Dynasty, Genghis Khan, et cetera, et cetera. So there were many similar experiences. Why was the United States different?
Well, I mean, the focus of certainly of my studies over the last 40 years has been mainly the U.S. vis-a-vis the U.S. domestically and the U.S. in the world. And over the last 5+ years since I retired, just reading U.S. history, Cold War, war on terrorism, et cetera, I think I tried to indicate, I think it's implicit and somewhere explicit in Williams. If not, maybe I'm confusing it because I actually went ahead and I've been looking at Parenti. The United States isn't different. I mean, in that sense, we're not an exception. Let's say to the supposedly the previous great Western capitalist empire, the British. And we, of course, moved the British out of the way, especially by the end of World War II, as well as the anti-colonial movements. So we're not an exception in terms of some living off of the labor of others. Despite the images, because I'm trying to think back to the history books I read as an undergraduate, that this notion of an empty continent, James Conant and others, a former president of MIT and others, talked about, you know, people came here and there was this vast empty continent. Well, the estimates are anywhere from 350 to 500 independent Indian nations north of the Rio Grande, all speaking their own languages. So it wasn't an empty continent. Of course, we didn't know that when we read the history books when we were 16 and 17. So I think the commonalities tie empires together in terms of exploiting resources, the necessity for violence in order to maintain the empires. So in that sense, I would see him really arguing that this notion of exception is wrong. But it's powerful. Even, I mean, you know, all of us are familiar with, even now after this Iraq report came out, that we're still pursuing democracy. We're still the world's best hope. We and the British, you know, it's got a little dog chain and Blair walks behind him. So despite everything, and that's why I think the critical thing is to understand the nature of this society, because if you understand the nature of this society, how could you make the argument that we can go anywhere and export democracy to anybody? I mean, they don't even have full democracy in voting rights in the District of Columbia. So it's amazing. It's just amazing. And maybe there's no rational explanation for this. I mean, Jeff's a trained psychologist. Maybe, you know, I've been reading a lot of Eric Fromm lately. Maybe, you know, we have to go into other explanations, because it's incredible that one could make this argument and get away with it generation after generation. Kit?
Okay, I have a somewhat different question. I'm Kit from San Fernando Valley. I'm troubled by the constant connection drawn in Williams between democracy and empire. I would like to think that you could have a democracy and a large, perhaps a prosperous democracy that wasn't imperialistic. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any necessary connection between these things. And yet we don't have many suggestions about how that might go in Williams. But I think it's extremely important to try and draw that, because I want to advocate democracy, but I don't want to advocate imperialism.
Well, I think in my comments in the book, when he discusses the nature of capitalism and its relentless expansion, democracy, as you know, as we think of as a political system, let's say even, you know, the normal understanding of democracy, as I understand it, certainly could exist without empire, without imperialism, but it couldn't be a democratic capitalism. Again, a system built on expansion. It seems to me that it's not inherent to the nature of democracy that it be expansionist. In fact, we do have the evidence from at least some of the first American nations that we're not inherently expansionist, and we're far more democratic in terms of coming together to make basic decisions about social life and if they ever went to war. And of course, those decisions also included women, unlike when the U.S. Constitution was passed. So I would agree with you. I think that's one of the weaknesses. In fact, when Basevich says that Williams, growing up when he did, coming off a farm in Iowa, I mean, a sense of a smaller town, America, had a hope for the country. But I think he's not a Marxist. I don't think his class analysis of the nature of this system sustains the kind of arguments he's making, even though with this book and the tragedy of American diplomacy and some of his other books, he certainly has gone after many of the sort of almost religious beliefs And he took a lot of, you know, he was one of the first revisionist historians and trained a lot of younger historians when he was at Wisconsin and then at Oregon. And he took a lot of abuse for saying what he did, because it was, you know, America was beyond, you know, he said this, these things before Vietnam, coming out of Eisenhower, Kennedy. But I threw the ball to Jeff. He has to say something.
Yeah, I'd like to say just a little bit, not as a psychologist, but as perhaps a behavioral scientist, because I've studied human violence in a lot of societies over a long period of time. And the impression I get is that irrationality, pretty high at the top of the list of our collective Homo sapien behavior. And you also really have to study, almost like an anthropologist, the mores of, quote, primitive tribes versus, of course, us who are highly civilized.
Of course.
And one of the things that seems to be, I don't want to say a universal, but extremely prevalent, is that any human group defines itself in some ways by its orientation to other human groups. And it's almost a universal. I mean, I went to UCLA, and for the week that you play USC, I mean, the hatred and vice versa. You know, this goes pretty deep. In a way, a person takes their identity by whatever little group or larger group that they exist in. And, you know, I'm an American, or I go to UCLA, or I'm a this, or I'm a that. And that always, what the obverse is, that there's always that other that is kind of not so good. You talked about projection. You know, that I think hatred and rage are part of our genetic heritage. All animals can, in a corner, can be aggressive. And the concept of we and they is almost an anthropological universal. When you break it down into geopolitical spheres, it becomes, I think, more understandable. There are all kinds of subgroups. It goes on and on and on. Eric Erickson wrote a book called Identity, Youth, and Culture, and it's a classic. And he wrote a very long essay on identity. And towards the end of that essay, he was going blah, 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 because I think he was coming to the conclusion that it's basically a hall of mirrors. If you keep on taking this logic to its final conclusion, that identity, in a sense, is a nebulous concept. It's not quite, I am Jeff Hirsch, or, you know, you're blah, blah, blah. At one level, we obviously are these identities, but at another level, it's not so obvious. A lot of people take, how should I put it, a lot of pseudo-security in identifying with something greater than they are for a lot of security needs. And, you know, a good demagogue takes great advantage of this kind of basic insecurity that a lot of people have.
Well, it may be then the insecurity, if we look at U.S. history, this insecurity, as I said, has been constant in and out, Republican, well, Whig and Democrats. The early Democratic Party was the Democratic Republican Party, the Whig Party, the Republicans, the Democrats, administration in and out. That over time, liberals, conservatives, it's been a long, long history of which I would argue of one regime. There have been different administrations, but one regime since 1789. The real founding of the country and the Constitution. And, I mean, it almost appears to be a universal, yet we do have anthropological and historical evidence. You know, we started with back, some of you remember, of course, remember back a year or two ago when we started with Zinn and the Columbus chapter. That kind of we and they antagonism may seem universal, yet we have from Columbus's own logs the incredible Pacific, beautiful behavior of the Taino on the island that he first set foot on, in which they were happy to give everything they had to other people. And also De Las Casas writes that these were not a violent people, and even when they were attacked, they withdrew, unlike the Arawak, who were much more militant in responding to Columbus. And we also know from hundreds of first encounters between Native Americans here and Europeans coming, that in virtually every one, in fact, Ward Churchill argues, in every single initial encounter between Europeans and the original Americans, the Europeans initiated violence, the first Americans did not. And so I think there's enough evidence to suggest that that potential is in all humans, but culturally some people have worked out ways where they're not as aggressive. And your example of football games, I mean, you turn it on, and I saw part of it, and they're all, especially young guys, of course, yelling into the TV, we're number one, we're number one. And that attitude is also linked to the country. You know, we're number one. That's what we've been since 1789, which is why we do not countenance defeat very well, which is why we're in a very difficult time.
Going back to your question, in talking about empire and imperialism, in this country we have prided ourselves as being capitalists and the other democratic. And it seems like this is a society that values capitalism and democracy, at least in name, and that becomes then a rationalization for imperial ways, imperialism and empire.
By the way, for those of you, some of you were at Michael Parenti's talk on the 7th and are familiar with his work in his book, which is now, I think, in the 7th edition, Democracy for the Few. We do have elements, stronger and weaker, depending on the time, of democracy in this country. And his argument, of course, is from the beginning, the advances of democratic rights and freedoms for working people, for women, for others, have always been struggled and fought for, and that the capital ruling class has always resisted that. And one of the things he pointed out is, and I forget who one of the founders was, who brought up the idea that perhaps we should have a Bill of Rights in the Constitution, and basically laughed. What are you kidding? I think that it was a unanimous vote, okay? And we know from the history of our country, even from our high school civics classes, that they had not included the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. That Constitution was not going to pass in certain states. So it's been this battle, you know, C, remember, C comes before D in the alphabet. Capitalism comes before democracy. And capitalism, I would argue, has been winning over democracy. For those of you who are movie fans, a great film. I also give little film reviews in these classes. But a great film from the 1950s with Robert Mitchum, or the early 60s, called The Night of the Hunter. And Marva Shelley Winters. And I remember he's a really whacked out preacher. I won't give you should see it yourself. But I remember he's in this theater. It's the struggle of love and hate. And he has it written, naturally, hate is on the left hand. Yeah, I'm left-handed and I don't like that. Well, my great uncle said, sinistra, evil, in Italian. You're left-handed, you're done for. Right hand, of course, was love. So if you had a hand with enough, with enough fingers to have capitalism and democracy, that's been the struggle, Parenti argues. And capitalism has usually been breaking the fingers of democracy. But now and then democracy forces in to extend the promise of democratic government and benefits for working people and social security, et cetera, et cetera. Always, always resisted by people in power. Always. You cannot name one example where they have not resisted this in U.S. history. So,
two things. One, democracy, my readings of U.S. history, has been basically, I won't say non-existent, but it determines the size of your vote, is much more determining the power you have, that the more money you have, the bigger your vote is, and the more control you have over society. We don't have like true democracy at one person, one vote type of thing here. It's according to how much you have is how powerful you are and how much you control. People try to look at democracy as every 4 years you elect a president and that's democracy. Well, democracy is a lot more than that. And for the rich, it's power or control over the military, police forces, and so on. And for the poor, it's usually fighting in the streets and factories and what have you. The other question we were talking about was the question of peoples and the developments of aggression and things of that nature. And I remember from the time I read Engels' Origin of the Family, State, Private Property, which is a long time ago, and from my own followings of different indigenous peoples in this country and in other parts of the world, it seems that the states that are more aggressive and more imperialistic and more bloodthirsty are the ones where private property is more accumulated in hands of fewer and fewer people. For example, as indigenous peoples, people like the Nahua, Aztecs, Maya, Incas, were much more imperialistic, bloodthirsty, and so on. But again, they were controlled more by priests, kings, and such, rather where the basic tribes were more sharing of their private properties and sharing with even other peoples as they did with European forefathers that came here that were received in open arms by these people for the most part. Comparing different tribes like down in the Amazon, the ones that seem to be more of the farmers, ones that hold on to the land and own it, are much more aggressive than the hunters and gatherers, who are very passive, peaceful people for the most part. One of the things he talks about was a question of the wealth and why, or not even why, but I was asking why certain peoples like the Aborigines are not grabbing and grubbing all this stuff. And that's basically because where he was saying that they're starving in the deserts in Australia, it's actually the contrary. They're actually able to live quite well in Australia, and they really don't have the problems until the Europeans came that other people might have in other parts of the world. But they're much more, or the Amazonian, are more able to take care of themselves through the environment that they live in rather than trying to grab everything that comes by.
Just one quick point. You know, if your high school was like mine, I mean, we learned about democracy. I never recall the word, I don't even think I recall the word in my college classes, capitalism. We had democracy. That's what we studied. We had a democratic system. The totalitarian societies didn't. And this is in the late 1950s when I was in high school. And you know which societies they were. We don't have to name them here. So it was democracy versus non-democracy. There was no discussion of sort of political economy, capitalism. So,
if I may, I'd like to make 2 points because what I like about Williams is that he really, from my understanding of what he wrote, is that since Europeans landed on this continent, that the rest was just inevitable, that there were some very visionary people that helped form the ideas of American society, but that without these people, it was going to be inevitable. As if you bought into the right of private property, and if you had your nuclear family, you know, we can update it to the American dream. Everybody has the American dream. I mean, I just bought my condo 5 years ago. That's my little piece of the pie. But I just really like the way he talked about, well, if you buy that, if you believe that everyone's entitled to that, and if you have a big continent with a huge, I was going to say that one of the differences is that we have just so much huge amount of resources. Every farm was producing excess and needed a market. Every industrialist was producing a huge amount and needed a market to expand. Then when he talks about the whole evolution of the idea of the benevolent policeman and how that if you're entitled to all these things, you know, private property, a market, a nuclear family, then you're entitled to defend that, quote unquote, in any way that just goes hand in hand. If you're entitled to all those things, you buy those things, you buy that you're entitled to police the world and have a policeman that's willing to defend those rights. And that just gets expanded in its scope up until the present day of invading everybody and everything for whatever reason we decide is necessary because we've bought the first part of it. And you can't accept the first part of it without accepting the second. I like the way he talked about that. But to go back to 1950s high school, and yeah, they didn't have to talk about capitalism, but I mean, I know you learned in high school that there was slavery. I know you learned in high school that we slaughtered the Indians. I mean,
no,
that was never hidden.
I'm older than you. We didn't learn that much about it.
You never saw, you know, cowboys and Indians on TV. You never learned that there was slavery.
I grew up with John Wayne movies.
Yeah,
I mean,
and the War of the South.
We were
you learned
cowboys, and we were killing Indians.
I mean, so and you learned about slavery. That wasn't hidden, I don't think, from your.
No, it wasn't hidden, but there was very, you know, you.
That there were slaves in America was
hidden. We had slavery, but at that time also, what that was balanced by the total historical garbage that we learned about Reconstruction after the Civil War, that blacks had some powers and they turned out to be corrupt and they were, you know, they drank liquor and they made a mess of all the southern legislatures. That's what we learned. We didn't learn, of course, that it was because of the freedmen, especially with some whites, that was the first time the public school system and education was established in the southern United States. But that's essentially what we learned. But again, there was no.
I'm saying it's like if you learned that there was slavery and that it existed, then you must have known in some part of your mind that this was not a democracy.
Yeah, but I always was
but it's easy
in
to
trouble
dismiss
in
it.
My high school. So I mean, not be, you know, most of, as I remember, most of my classmates, it was another topic you got through. And remember, this is, again, I'm talking about American history. This is the spring of 1958. This is after Little Rock High School, and this is after stuff is on TV. And this is in a high school where there was real tension between blacks and whites in the locker rooms, et cetera, except when we then had to go to another school because we were playing together. Then everybody was a brother. But I want to ask you a question on what you raised. Do you think that there was something already in what the Europeans brought to these shores that sort of made this inevitable in terms of their fundamental assumptions that when they came here, that clash was inevitable with people who had communal societies? I mean, some American Indian nations, including the Cherokee, at a later point, did have slaves, by the way. But overwhelmingly, these were communal communist societies were property held in common. There was no, driving around upstate New York to be a sign, Cayuga Nation for sale, $89 an acre. No such thing. You couldn't buy. It didn't happen. So it was this almost because of what people brought here that caused the inevitable conflict? Or was it something that happened after they got here?
I don't think that it was human nature to slaughter the Indians, but I think that European people were brought here to expand Europe, to expand Spain, to expand England. They were brought here, as pawns to settle the lands and grab what they could get. And I think that there wasn't a communal tradition in Europe. They just carried on with their Britishism or their Spanishism. like you say and he says, they brought the empire with them and then they wanted their own. They were tired of exporting the majority of their wealth and ceding control to Britain. And they said, we're going to be our own boss and we're going to take advantage. And of course, not everybody gets in on it to the same degree, but everyone buys it, that that's the way to go.
Everyone, to some degree, has to buy into the ideology, but clearly in terms of the nature of the society, being a class society, some are going to rule over others. One final point, there was something in the paper recently. Despite Europeans coming here and being saved, literally, in Virginia and in what is now Cape Cod, because the Pilgrims, that's all we learned about. We learned about the Mayflower and the Pilgrims. We didn't learn anything about the Spanish in what is now the southern United States. So the Pilgrims come, and they don't land at Plymouth Rock. They land first at what is now Provincetown at the end of the Cape. They survived the first winter because of the help they got from, it was the Wampanoag, I forget which particular tribe. And that did not change the fundamental conflict that came after began around 1637, and it's continued ever since. So
I thought that was a very lucid and interesting lecture.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could clarify one point. I've never seen the Constitution as a precursor of empire or imperialism. I think of it, the thought comes to my mind as it's a little bit more like technology, which is neutral in many ways and can be used in one fashion or another. So that I wonder whether, rather than being inherent in the Constitution, that imperialism would follow, that it's the way the Constitution was used rather than something inherent in the Constitution itself.
Well, there I was trying to lay out his argument, because coming into this, I probably had the same view of the Constitution. I mean, I had read Beard a long time ago, and remember being in a meeting almost 20 years ago at the college where I taught, where there was a conference on bringing together U.S. and Soviet scholars looking at the U.S. Constitution. And the Soviet scholars who were there, who were guests of the State University, thought the Constitution was this amazing, progressive document. And sniping from the back, I was sitting next to him, and I've known him for 20 years since, was Michael Parenti, arguing in a comradely way. These were guests, and it was a wonderful dialogue, saying, well, look, what is this progressive document here? In terms of fundamental political rights, there are none for women. Forget about Indians, that's out. It maintained slavery, though it was going to end the importation of slavery in 1808. So in that sense, I could see it as not being the grand democratic institution. So I kind of struggle with this as well. Is it inherent on bringing these colonies together that we must therefore have empire?
I would probably lean that there are other fundamental assumptions that are necessary to understand. He really doesn't deal much with racism, for example, in terms of the hierarchical nature of how white Europeans dealt with first Americans and African peoples as being fundamental. The idea of having a structure of government, even if it's undemocratic, clearly looking back, we realize that consistent struggle over 200 plus years has widened the democratic rights and liberties in the Constitution, and I would argue for the better, all right? I mean, let's face it. I mean, you think of, it wasn't much in 1789, and it's, you know, people may still have critiques, but it ain't 1789, and in terms of the vote and other things. So I'd have to, you know, I was trying to follow his line of reasoning. So I'd have to, your comment lead me to think that through, because I'm not sure.
You see, to say that the Constitution wasn't entirely democratic doesn't say that it was pro-imperial.
Right, right.
That's a bit of a jump, I think.
Yeah.
I was going to jump in here for a second and go back to your question. Is there anything exceptional about America in terms of its development as an empire or not? And what I go back to is that within any tribal conflict, which to me, the development of empire is a tribal conflict writ large, where you take the social mores within a tribe and you make a determination that you want more resources. And then you have to perhaps rewrite your tribal self-image around the idea that you're entitled to them because you're superior in some way, as opposed to another group. And I think that's gone on throughout whatever history, whatever empirical process has gone through that. I mean, flashing on God is with us and blazing on the belt buckles of Hitler's stormtroopers. I mean, there always seems to be this, if you're going to deny somebody of their resources and even take their life to do it, you have to assure yourself or the people that you talk into going about this task that there's some hereafter for you. This is not a murder. This is not thievery. This is something that the gods want to happen. This is something that heaven will shine on you for this. And I think that aspect has always been there too. And it was definitely there, I think, in the Calvinists who came to these shores. I mean, Zen has that great piece where he talks about the early pilgrims or whatever deciding that or maybe it was Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, where they wanted a trading post on Manhattan, the Wampanoags wouldn't give it to them, so they snuck out and slaughtered them all. And then they really congratulated themselves about how this was proof of God's grace. But the thing that strikes me is maybe just an extension along the same line of that process is the perfection of the hypocrisy to the approachment of schizophrenia or something that I think forms the basis of American identity, where Thomas Jefferson says that all men are created equal. This is the justification by which we will go to war against our paternal empire, because all men are created equal, because we are your equal, and you're not treating us like equals, with the implicit understanding that we're making this determination so that we can form our own empire, so that we can oppress others. The understanding was so that they could go out and take more land from the Indians because the British had stopped them at the Allegheny Mountains due to their treaty with the French. I mean, that was one of the big sticking points, along with the British East India Company and the rest and the taxes and all that. So, I mean, it's just like from that, the whole thing was developing over time, but that you look at the colonial mentality at that time, and it was this perfect synchronous idea of individual freedom and what that means, and empire being the basis of it. I don't know enough about history to know whether that is unique, but it certainly seemed to be an improvement in the design, if you will, or an advancement of the imperial ideology.
Reading the Declaration of Independence, I mean, it's got one of the big, most racist things I've ever seen written into the Declaration of Independence when it deals with Native Americans. Thomas Jefferson, who was a quote-unquote naturalist, equated Africans to be related to orangutans. White men were not. White men were created by God as Africans were basically animals. The Constitution was written by a conservative group of people from the Revolution. The radicals, they basically made concessions to by adding on the Bill of Rights. But basically it was set up as a conservative document, be able to give them more control over this country. If we look back into Europe at one time was communal. And then various things happened to various groups and they became increasingly private property oriented and accumulation, and all the ships that came over here and all the colonies they set up were all financial enterprises. All you have to do is look at that movie they did recently, Pocahontas. That whole colony that was set up, and it was very obvious from looking at it, was set up on a class basis and was set up to make some rich people richer. And well, that's basically what the colonies were set up for. So they naturally would have to progress into what we have today.
See, and that's when I mentioned about what we learned in high school, this simply, and I haven't done a recent study, empirical study, on what kids are learning in high schools today. I mean, Zinn's book is in some high schools in the country. But this notion of the colony and exploitation, and even a very careful understanding at our level of intellect as young people, even an in-depth understanding of the Constitution and the debates and the Federalist Papers. I would argue, I mean, you could disagree with what Madison and Jefferson stood for, but there's no group of political officials in the history of this country who have written treatises about government to come close to Jefferson and Madison, Hamilton, the gang in terms of the Federalist Papers, Hamilton, Madison, Jay, and then Jefferson's writings. Even granting the supporting empire and slavery and, when Jefferson meant all men are created equal, he meant men. He did not mean women. Jefferson was a white propertied men. And, Jefferson was right there with Rousseau when it came to his attitudes about the education of women, which were basically to make them adornments to men. So you're talking about the best that the system had to offer. But they gave very serious thought to running a country. So you can dismiss them on substantive grounds. But when you look at what goes for political discourse today, and even Clinton and others, Clinton's very articulate, Rhodes Scholar, well-schooled, etc. I mean, they don't even come close to these guys. So we were never given that access to the critical kinds of things that we're discussing here so that you could even begin to say, wow, there are 55 guys. They were merchants. They weren't a monolithic group, but they were merchants, and some were slave owners, and, they came up with this particular document. The notion that Beard raised, that maybe their class interest had something to do with what they wrote, which seems to me to be pretty much common sense, otherwise they'd be fools, that was never raised to even examine and even to reject. And you say, oh, this guy Charles Beard, ridiculous. So we can't do a critique on it because we didn't have the tools by which to have access to examine it.
Hi, Jay again. I'll just follow up on some of the points that were earlier made, but particularly with the question from the gentleman here, forgot your name, Charles. This, in my opinion, it's not a unique experience, the United States. Absolutely not unique. That the more I dig into world history, everything is so, so connected. And particularly in the comments that John, our professor, has just finished making, the role of religion. The role of religion is to the French Revolution, which is the basis of the thinking of the French Enlightenment, was the basis of the American Revolution, which preceded the French by 10 years. But it was based on French ideals, equality, fraternity, liberté. Those are all the concepts, but they were founded in religious bases that they were trying to break away from the stranglehold that religion had on Europe at the time. So when those first invaders from Europe came to the United States and called themselves Americans, it was, as we well know, a very strong religious basis, which fed into this entire question of power and how do we get more for ourselves and how do we suppress those people around us who aren't like us. The only exception I can think of in most of world history is the Jews and the Muslims in Spain, predating 1492 by roughly 1,000 years. Jews and Muslims lived happily together in Spain for almost 1,000 years up to the beginning of the Inquisition, which, of course, was the Catholics when they, Isabel and Ferdinand, got together. But that was only when Catholicism took over Spain. Preceding that, for 1,000 years, Jews and Muslims got along absolutely terrific. That was based on a sense of social justice. The social justice point, that's my final aspect of this, comes back to what Jeff Hirsch said earlier about the psychology of all this. And I think the psychology is based on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. First, you go with the food, clothing, shelter needs. Once those are done, it keeps creeping up to get to the plenty of money and plenty of luxury goods. At the very, very top of the hierarchy of needs is power. And that's what I think is driving every little story that, and massive story we've talked about of world conquest, of empire, is power, and it's going on today, of course, in Iraq and everywhere else. Look at the motives of the different countries and the major players. It's all around power and control, not whether they've got their basic food, clothing, shelter. It's how much more can we control. That's the basic psychology of it. That was confronted by the movement of socialism from the 1850s till today. It's still alive and strong, the concept of socialism, even though the phrase may not be used. I choose to use the concept of social and economic justice, which is another word for socialism, but that is the fight, and I think that's why we're all here, and we must clearly fight back in the interest of social justice and economic justice against these power moves otherwise called capitalism.
I hate to change the subject, I think a lot of the day-to-day fighting from the frontier took place by the poor, and the rich used the poor to fight the Indians. The only land available to the poor was land on the frontier where that was dangerous and where they had to fight off the Indians. There were organized wars, but I think a lot of the day-to-day stuff was sort of orchestrated by the rich. I mean, they forced the poor people to, if they wanted land, they had to go out and fight for it, at least from Zinn. That was my impression from Zinn.
But those doing the fighting, those doing the working, there's an element of coercion and at different levels, and could be coercion up to sheer terror. But at the same time, even though violence in this society is an ever-present element, especially against oppressed racial minorities more than any other group, it also has to be an element of people internalizing the social patterns of the society in which it then takes on a force in their own psychology. Jay's comment about religion. We hear the same things about the U.S. being benevolent, that we still have a right to go forth in the world. If the U.S. doesn't do it, I mean, we hear it from Bennett and Hansen and Bush and Clinton and all, you know, it doesn't matter, that if the U.S. isn't the country to really help bring about democracy and freedom, I mean, who's going to do it? Of course, what couldn't be the Soviet Union prior to the demise of the Soviet Union, and now post-Soviet and socialist world, the second world, we're the ones to do it. So that deep, pervasive belief, almost becomes like a second life to people, because that will then allow them to support that ideology and, if necessary, kill for it. I would argue, in terms of its essence, there's no fundamental difference between how Bush articulates it now, and especially articulated by the Christian right, and how Jonathan Edwards and the Puritans articulated it 3-4 centuries ago. I mean, I think it's still powerful. It's a Christian, forget about a Judeo-Christian tradition. For those of you who are Jewish, this is a Christian nation. And for those who are really out there in left field, like what's his name in Minnesota, who was a Muslim and who was elected to Congress and is going to take the oath on the Quran, and which is driving all the right-wing radio hosts crazy, okay? Even though the Constitution forbids any religious test, by the way, for office. Though a Muslim now can be elected to Congress, gay people can be elected, disabled people, black people, women. An atheist, not a snowball's chance in hell would an atheist have a chance of being elected to any office in the Congress of the United States, at least openly, an open atheist. Closet atheist, maybe. So it's that ideology, those beliefs are deeply held. I'm talking about the people you were talking about, Ken, working people, poorer people. Of course, there's a lot of cynicism in terms of rulers. They'd be happy to use people, use them up, and, you know, they use them up as workers, they use them up as cannon fodder, whatever. But until you break that ideological hold, I don't see any change coming in the country.
Going back to your first question has stimulated a lot of response throughout the evening. My take on it is that at a larger conceptual level, the reason for empire building is quite similar in terms of geography, treasure, and power. But under that, the rationale in different countries differ, and from time to time differ. So that with the English Empire, bringing civilization was a large part of the rationale. Why you do this with a little bit of a religious tinge also. In the United States, a providence, religious kind of thing, and more recently, spreading democracy as the rationale. with the Soviet Union post-World War II, it was security, which probably had some realistic aspects, but also some justification for some elbow using in going into different nations. So that it seems to me it's the rationale that differs, and that what Williams was doing was simply spelling out the rationale in the U.S. situation, rather than saying necessarily that this is different than anything that anybody else ever said.
It's 9 o'clock. Ira wanted to make a comment.
Let me return to the notion of empty land. It goes back to the mid-1500s. Up until that time, society was in Europe was largely religion-oriented, but it was making a transition to secular ways of thinking. Now, there was a legal scholar who was secular, Hugo Grotius, and he was a high-level executive in the Dutch East India Company. In fact, he was in Indonesia, what we today call Indonesia, for quite a while, and busy enslaving people, especially in the Spice Islands. But he's considered the father of modern secular international law. There is a branch of law called international law. So he wrote about that. He tried to move the study of law away from Christianity and, you know, religious principles and make it secular. So he invented, apparently, the notion of empty land. He used Latin. He wrote in Latin, of course, although he was Dutch. Coined the phrase terra nullius. Terra means land, nullius is like null, empty land. Now, the Europeans were fighting one another, all over Asia particularly, for land. Now, some of the land they came upon really was empty, certain islands in the Pacific. So there didn't seem to be any question as to whose land that would be. Whoever got there first, you know, got to dominate it. But then there were other places which were not empty of humans, such as Ireland. Well, Ireland had a lot of people when the British decided to dominate it. But they had no problem in justifying what they were doing. They said, well, yeah, there are millions of Irish. But they cannot work the land very fruitfully. We are more advanced agriculturally. We can do a better job. Therefore, we are entitled to the land because, in a sense, it is empty. It's simply filled with Irish. And this argument was used again and again and again in America's the expansion of the Europeans across the American continent. Again, they're just savages. We should get rid of them. In fact, George Washington was opposed after the Revolution to Indian communities being established near white communities, because he said, well, eventually we're going to have to get rid of these creatures. They're like vermin. They're like serpents. They stand in the way of civilization. If we let them develop communities near us, we'll develop sympathies for them. It won't be as easy for us to exterminate them as if they're kept at arm's length. But there was no doubt in his mind that they were not human, or not fully human, and therefore the whole land between the Atlantic and Pacific was empty, in a sense, and white people, being real humans, deserved it. So it doesn't really matter if land is empty of people or has a lot of people, whether they're Europeans. By the way, the Europeans butchered one another in Indonesia. The Dutch slaughtered the British around the 1563 over the right to exploit the Spice Islands. It's a famous situation where the Dutch rounded up British members of a company, a spice company. They rounded them up and stabbed them and slashed them to death. What did I say?
West British East India.
No, but it was the Dutch East India Company that slaughtered the British, which then led to the British retaliating under the Duke of York to slaughter the Dutch in the New World. And the Duke of York took over New Amsterdam and renamed it after himself, New York. But it was an act of vengeance involving, you know, fights among Europeans. So the conclusion you can come to about all this, I think, was summarized by Marx. He said it is not a man's consciousness that determines their being. Rather, it is their social being that determines their consciousness. If the people involved are capitalists and they must expand, they must conquer, they must do all those things, they'll find some way of justifying it. It could be the land is empty, the land is full, the land has Indians or it doesn't have Indians, the moon is empty, we should take that. The Soviets are evil, we should get to the moon before them. It really doesn't matter. All these discussions are kind of peripheral to that one principle, that humans will always justify according to whatever their moral system is, whatever it is they want to do. It doesn't matter. That's all.
Thank you. See all of you, I hope, in January. I'll send you a reminder, and have a happy holiday and a safe one. Thank you.
You have been listening to Empire as a Way of Life, a lecture and discussion series given by Dr. John Marciano. This group meets monthly until June of 2007. At the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. the LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.